Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Allison Stewart, and at the top of the hour, you heard our conversation around a lawsuit against Prince George's County Jail filed by inmates awaiting trial who allege that an outbreak of COVID-19 in the facility is the result of neglect and a dereliction of duty to protect people awaiting trial while they're in state's custody. My next guest has spent a career looking at structures in the criminal justice system, not just the buildings used for incarceration, but also looking into the systems and structures that act like funnels for mass incarceration in the first place. And when Deanna Van Buren looks at this and what she often sees design problems. She's onto something. Recently, the New York chapter of the American Institute of Architects called on its members, quote, to no longer design unjust, cruel, or harmful spaces of incarceration within the current United States justice system, such as prisons, jails, detention centers, and police stations. We instead urge our members to shift their efforts towards supporting the creation of new systems, processes, and typologies based on prison reform, alternatives to imprisonment, and restorative justice. Joining me now is Deanna Van Buren, Executive Director of Designing Justice and Designing Spaces, an Oakland-based architecture and real estate development nonprofit trying to address the root causes of mass incarceration, poverty, racism, as well as the criminal justice system itself. You may have seen her TED Talk called What a World Without Prisons Could Look Like. Deanna, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Allison. I'm happy to be here.
So we were talking about this lawsuit in particular, this one particular facility, and the lack of COVID-19 safety measures. This is just a big picture question. This is to you as someone who understands design. What is it about the way jails and prisons are laid out that make them not great facilities to contain the spread of a disease?
Sure. Well, it's called congregant living, right? So folks mm-hmm. are living together in close quarters. Right, because people don't have their own room or their own small unit. They're eating together. They're recreating together. It's, you know, not unlike what you saw in elder care facilities, right? Mm. Everyone's sort of living together. And in this case, it's even worse, right? There's not a lot of fresh air coming through, right? The things that we know, like, oh, I'm talking to you. We want fresh air flowing through the facility. You don't have that. People, they don't have enough hygiene opportunities, right? They're all showering together. It's the worst case scenario that you could imagine for the spread of a pandemic.
I'm going to ask you to help us a little bit of design history, and then we'll go into future. If we look at the past, sometimes it helps us understand the future. Traditionally, what functions have traditional prisons been designed around? What are those buildings meant to do?
Sure. You know, but prisons and jails are designed to separate folks from society. They're generally designed to punish, right? If you look at the physicality of them, there's you deserve this, right? Like you've done bad and you need to go to a bad place, and security, right? And control. Those are sort of the primary foundations upon which they're built, and they do it very well. And they look exactly as they were intended to look.
How is the architecture of these sort of old school prisons, which, as you said, look like they're supposed to look, at odds with the goal, the should-be goal of rehabilitation?
Sure. Well, you know, whether they're old prisons or new prisons, right, there have been many iterations of this building type. You know, my advocacy, Allison, is that regardless of what it looks like, it is built on the foundations of slavery, as our criminal justice system has proven and been shown to be. So architecture is merely a reflection of society's values, right, and beliefs. And we will build exactly what we believe, and that's what we've done. So the architecture of prisons and jails is reflective of that in every aspect of its inception. And I think as long as we are looking at a system built on structural racism, you can't make that prettier and have it have any impact. You know, right. we have to address the root cause of the issue and the historical genesis of these buildings.
My guest is Deanna Van Buren, Executive Director of Designing Justice and Designing Spaces. Let's take a look at two of your initiatives. There was a nice New York Times write-up of your work. There's a drug intervention facility that you helped design in Syracuse, New York, and a mobile refuge in San Francisco that shelters women who are released from jail overnight. And it's interesting because both of these projects were designed in collaboration with the people who would ultimately use them and need them. Can you give us an example of something that was included or that was changed because of the input of the affected communities?
Sure. And just to clarify, the Syracuse Peacemaking Center was for quality of life crimes, right? So people are getting diverted out of court and into peacemaking that was facilitated by the elders. So very exciting project. Mm-hmm. But I'll speak to the Women's Mobile Refuge vehicle. I thought going into the jail, so we worked with about 60 women inside of the county jail in San Francisco. I thought they were going to want beds, right? They're getting out in the middle of the night. They'd probably want to sleep. So in my mind, I packed out this trailer with all these beds. And when I went in to work with them, I realized pretty quickly that I was way wrong, right? That the beds were the last thing that they wanted to have in there. They've been in sleeping in beds all day, every day, sitting in hard plastic chairs or tables bolted to the ground, right? What they wanted was to get ready, right? To get ready for the next day, to find out where their family is, where are they going to stay. They wanted a change of clothes. They wanted to meet with a caseworker. They wanted to sit in a soft, comfortable chair, right? So simple. And so that's what we did. We didn't put any beds in this thing. They're beautiful, soft, comfortable chairs. There's a little kitchen. They can get something to drink, something to eat. There's a private room where they can meet with a caseworker. There's a bathroom. They want to put on their makeup if they wear it. You know, they want it to be what's taking next steps. And the last thing they want to do is sleep.
That's so interesting. I mean, really, what
did you think?
What did you really think when you first heard that? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Allison.
I'm kind of getting into the idea of like, oh my gosh, you know, when you have that sort of that one of those epiphanies.
Yeah. It's like, well, you know, it's like, oh my God, thank God I listened, right? Mm-hmm. Thank God I came in. While there's a part of me that had an idea, there's always this part of me that goes in as an empty vessel. And I'm like, oh, thank goodness I'm holding it that way. Because if I wasn't, we would have gotten it all wrong. And then who have you helped? Nobody.
What is the appetite like for alternatives within the justice system?
Yeah, well, it's growing, right? It's not like it was 10 years ago where people were like, what's restorative justice, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're seeing it in a lot of places, very much due to the uprisings we've seen, very much due to COVID impact on what we're seeing inside of prisons and jails. And I think, you know, we're seeing some exciting initiatives like in LA County, where they've passed, you know, an alternatives to incarceration roadmap, you know, to create a distributed network of care. That's incredibly exciting, right? We're not going to build mental health jails. Instead, we're going to build this whole constellation of like restorative care villages and other things that are going to bring health and wellness to people. That's radically, and it's happening. Like, it's happening right now. So the appetite is growing. It's increasing. It's increasing its scale and scope. And we're so glad to be a part of all this. Finally happening.
What's the obstacle? What's the most stubborn obstacle to this, to the work you do?
Sure. Well, I think one is people's identity, right, around criminal justice. They are very tied to the beliefs and values of that system. And getting them to break out of that kind of thinking is challenging, right? If I'm a career correction officer, if I'm a career sheriff, right, I'm not able to see that because it might mean the end of my job, right? I don't do this anymore. So that can be really challenging. The level of collaboration required and multidisciplinary approach, you know, getting way out of the silos is just something people aren't used to doing and don't have the skill set to do, and systems aren't set up for that. So that also has to happen, is we really have to work across departments, you know, across counties, across states, you know, to be able to get all this to work together well.
My guest is Deanna Van Buren, Executive Director of Designing Justice and Designing Spaces. I mentioned that TED Talk that you gave in 2017 called What a World Without Prisons Could Look Like. And in the talk, you describe that your work is at the intersection of justice and design, and you think about it by looking at schools and specifically the school-to-prison pipeline. Now, where does design fit into the idea of the well, the idea, the reality of the school-to-prison pipeline?
You know, in the early days, I was doing a lot of research at restorative justice programs in schools, right? This is a policy shift. Like, we're going from, you know, this zero tolerance situation, like you're out of the school, to a restorative justice way of addressing any conflict in the school system. And that is really transformed a lot of schools. And so when I went to sort of see how they were doing it, what the environment was looking like, you know, I was seeing in some cases they really needed a special place to do it, right? Young people needed to know where to go to be able to address what had just happened. It's a safe space, right? Neutral space in the school itself. You know, the program providers, the facilitators, they needed a place of refuge, right? So it was almost starting to carve out this space of refuge within the school where people could go to resolve conflict and to rest. And realizing that that was essential if you're going to make that shift, that you need to rethink certain spaces in the schools to be able to support that.
You talk about also in this talk, and I've seen in some of your other work, this idea of restorative economics.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that start from a design standpoint?
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm an architect and a designer, and I realized that if we wanted to make these new prototypes, right, new spaces and new buildings to end mass incarceration and support alternatives, that we also had to think about the financing, right? And we talk about root causes, like why do people commit crimes, right? It's often they just don't have their basic needs met, right? They don't have a job. We're looking at huge structural inequity, economic inequity, and we have to build that into our projects, and we have to provide both the financial thinking and the design. And so everything is design, right? You designed your outfit when you got up this morning, right? So it's about thinking creatively about money and and the physical space and the programs and the policies all together to come up with the right solution. And restorative economics is built into our projects, both through the community owning something, to having a workforce development programming in the building so people get job training there. So we're always looking to find ways for the community to invest in the project and to get access to a way for economic mobility, right, and financial wealth. And so it's important that we think that way on everything that we do, as designers too.
When you're creating these spaces, is it important to create space for advocates and activists to be involved as well?
Yeah. You know, I feel like a lot of our projects now are just really in close collaborations with activists and organizers. You know, we're working alongside them. We're creating spaces for them. I think they're really on the front lines, and they're really the ones that we are serving, right? They're leading us, right? And we support them and what it is that they're trying to do and the kind of changes they're trying to make. Like, if we look at in L.A., with this distributed network of care, it was the LA Justice Coalition that got that to happen, right? To push the supervisors in Atlanta, working for Women on the Rise and the Racial Justice Action Center, it was them that pushed the mayor to commit to closing the jail downtown, right? Mm-hmm. So making space for them is essential. I mean, I'm just glad they make space for us so we can be on the team with them.
You mentioned it earlier, that this idea of these mobile villages and pop-up community centers that offer a variety of resources. What's the value in making the resources mobile as opposed to something that is firm and permanent?
Sure, that's a good question. You know, I think the mobile piece came out because there was so much need, and the building of bricks and mortar infrastructure is expensive and it takes time. And the beauty of pop-up infrastructure is it's smaller and lightweight, and because it moves, you can serve more people, possibly. And, you know, and this is an interim. We love pop-up to permanent. Like, we don't want to lose our eyes on the prize about the permanent piece. But the pop-up infrastructure can help people rethink their public space differently. Like, oh, yeah, last week there was this great pop-up village here, and I got my hair cut, and I got access to a, you know, acupuncturist, and I got to go to my classes, and the kids got taken care of. And so they know that it's coming, and we're able to just bring it to these the communities that really, really need it in areas where there's just no resources, right? So pop-up infrastructure can penetrate deeply into community. And we've seen this in a lot of cities, including in New York, where they're doing farmers markets and a lot of the housing developments.
I'm curious what you're working on right now.
Oh, the list is so long, Allison. I'll start from macro to micro, maybe just the three sort of buckets of work. You know, one is restorative reinvestments in community. So we're working on something called the Love Campus in Detroit, which is a social justice campus that will have everything from, you know, food enterprises and micro retail for local residents to a de-escalation center, possibly, right? That's a large project that we're working on, and we'll hopefully see constructed by 2022.
Sounds great.
And in our repurposing and reimagining, we are still working in Atlanta to see the Atlanta City Detention Center repurposed into a center for equity.
And quickly, what's the third? We're about to run out of time. What's the third?
And the third is a pop-up room for folks coming home from prison and jail. God knows, as we decarcerate, we really are going to need a lot of these. So those are the three.
My guest has been Deanna Van Buren, Executive Director of Designing Justice and Designing Spaces. Thanks for sharing your work with us, Deanna.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive, and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.